8 days. We are exactly 8 days away from Super Bowl X-Lix, everybody. I, for one, can't wait. There's so much that's going into this Super Bowl. Super Bowl 49 is the actual name of it, okay? But, you know, X-Lix is kind of a funnier thing to say. This is the first Super Bowl that I can remember that had this much nonsense leading up to it. I mean, we've seen Super Bowls with nonsense before, but this, it's borderline silly season right now in the NFL. And we're going to break it all down this evening. We're going to take a quick look back at the AFC and NFC Championship games, and we're going to look ahead to the week that is leading up to the Super Bowl. And we're going to break down the game, and we're going to decide who's going to win this game. Welcome to the Hip Hop Sports Report Podcast. Jay Hicks is on the mic today. We're actually going to be recording this probably on different days. So this is the first day of the recording. Officially, it's, for the record, Saturday, January 24th, 2015. And we're going to be talking to a few of our friends here, friends of the podcast, guys you all know and love and respect as I do. We're going to start off with our good friend Anthony Houston. Let's go ahead and give him a call.
Yo.
What's going on?
Sitting here watching Game of Thrones, looking at this little boy that won't go away.
That's excellent.
How's 30 Life adjusted?
30 Life is good. 30 Life is pretty good. What's funny about that is, well, I'll get to that in a second, but basically, I actually called you to do a quick 20-minute impromptu podcast, and we're actually recording right now.
Awesome.
Yeah, so are you available? Are you free? Are you tied up with the kids in Game of Thrones?
We're just usually about to feed in dinner, so I can probably do 20 minutes of podcasting in between raspberries.
That is excellent. That is excellent. Thank you for joining us again, Anthony Houston, and friend of the podcast. And we're going to talk football. We tend to talk football all the time. But real quick, to make reference to what you were saying, yes, I did just have a birthday just yesterday. So, and I appreciate all those who stopped to wish me happy birthday and everything. It was kind of a milestone birthday, so that was really cool. And really felt the love, you know? Really felt the love. I'm kidding. But, you know, still, it was nice, though. It was nice. I appreciate everybody who took a moment to stop through on social media, whatever, wish me, you know, HBD. And I'm feeling like I can go forward into this next decade of life with renewed vigor. And I'm going to do that, and I'm going to attack the website and the podcast in a way that reflects that. Speaking of the podcast, again, I was calling you to talk a little football. Now, the listeners don't know this, Anthony. You and I have not spoken on the phone in over a week. It's been since last Sunday's championship game weekend. So last week's NFC championship game was on Sunday. We have not spoken since your Green Bay Packers fell to the Seattle Seahawks. And that was a very conscious decision on my part. I wanted to get a fresh, not that we haven't discussed it in small parts through text and on Twitter and whatnot, but I wanted to get a fresh take of you. I didn't want to call you too soon because I thought it might be a little too raw yet. But I wanted to get your opinion first on the NFC Championship game, how you're feeling about it, how are Packers fans by and large feeling about it, and who is to blame at this? Because I feel like the blame could be placed like 50 different places. I feel like it was more on Green Bay than it was on Seattle.
Okay, so first I'm going to answer the question reverse. The blame goes to the head coach primarily because. When your defense is completely, basically, dominating, for lack of a better term, they shut it down on offense. And the Green Bay Packers are built to win with offense and enough defense. So they shut it down on offense, which that's the only reason why, basically, you can have Russell Wilson get a concussion and play like you got a concussion and still lose the game. They shut it down pretty much completely. They were playing the clock. They were playing not to lose, which is a popular phrase. And, you know, when you gotta beat the man, to beat the man, you gotta beat the man. And they refused to beat the man. They were just trying to run out the clock. Which too much time. Which there wasn't even too much time when people refer to, when you talk about blame, people refer to that last interception where they decided to not return it. One, there's no guarantee he returns the ball for a touchdown. And, you know, there's no guarantee that he doesn't fumble it. They know that they have the ball then, and they were going to give the ball back with under 5 minutes. Seahawks only had one timeout and a 2 minute warning to stop the clock. And they were giving it to the best quarterback in the game. So there's a lot of blame to go around. There's no one particular thing. Like, you want to initially, as you can imagine, people were blaming Brandon Bostic for dropping that onside kick. But that was like number 7 in the list of things that had to happen in a very short amount of time to even put them in a situation where the Seahawks could have a chance to even win the game. And even then, they still had to get a coin toss right. They had to basically have the perfect play call and hit the guy who they had not hit all game and had interceptions on every pass to him and incompletion. So, you know, by the time the game was over, or by the time the Seahawks were back in the game, I was just kind of like, you know, okay, well, this is just getting ridiculous. Because even the chokiest of teams don't have that level of unluckiness. So that's kind of where it is now. You know, we still got Aaron Rodgers, and we're probably going to lose to a team who I think is favored to win the championship. So it is what it is.
I mean, there was, like you said, there was about 7 or 8 different things that all went wrong inside the last 5 minutes of the game. I thought that if you had to point the finger at one specific play, you know, in a gun to your head kind of situation, the onside kick where Bostic just simply did not do his job, that's probably the number one play that you come up with. Because he was the guy that had the onside kick go right off his face mask when, in actuality, according to the special teams coaching staff of the Packers, he was supposed to block on that play, and Jordy Nelson, who was standing just behind him, was supposed to catch the ball. Now, with that being said, there's no guarantee that Jordy catches the ball, and there's a lot of other variables. A lot of people like to play armchair quarterback after games like that and just say, well, this should have happened, and if this didn't happen, and it's easy now that we know the outcome. But during the game, there was some stuff that just I was completely blown away by. I actually did not have a problem with the Packers taking the points early on in the game, just kicking the field goals instead of going for touchdowns on 4th and 1 from the 1 yard line, 4th and goal from the 2 yard line. I didn't have a problem with that because I'm like, look, Seattle is a team that's built on a defense and it fuels their offense. They're not an offensive team, and get the points where you can on that defense because it's difficult to get down there. I mean, even for the full game, Rodgers was only 19 of 34 for 178 and a touchdown and 2 picks. So it's not like he was flawless. He was far from it in that game. You take the points when you can get it. And for all those people criticizing Mike McCarthy for being a little passive at the beginning of the game, if that onside kick is recovered or if 5 other things don't go against Green Bay in the final minutes, they win the game. So that wasn't the reason why they lost it, I didn't think. The interception where I think it was Morgan Burnett just slid down after that pick late with 5 minutes left, I thought was bizarre at the time because there was like at least 30 yards in front of him. I can't say, Anthony, that he would have scored, but he would have ran a little ways, and there was a decent chance for him to score on that play. And then the 2-point conversion I thought was bizarre. How I think it was HaHa Clinton Dix was in coverage, and I used the word coverage very loosely. He just let the pass get completed. Like, I don't really know what kind of angle he was taking. He looked like he had money on the game on that play, which is really bizarre because he had 2 picks in that game. Like, he played the game of his life up to that point. There was just a lot of stuff that just kind of, I mean, the defense just collapsed out of the blue. But here's one thing that really jumped out to me. Two things, actually. One was the fake field goal that Seattle scored on in, I believe that was in the second quarter, fairly late in the third quarter, I might add. But it was 16-0, and Seattle hadn't gotten anything going on offense all day. And I said on Twitter, it's very hard to predict when a fake is going to come. But in that play, in that scenario, that's the kind of scenario where you can envision somebody faking a field goal. And the fact that Green Bay was completely caught with their pants down was bizarre to me. The other thing was how the Packers, if you look back at how they ended the game against New England during the regular season, the Patriots missed on their opportunity to take the lead, and then they missed the field goal. And then Green Bay had the ball with about 5 minutes to go, and they needed to get like 2 first downs basically to end the game. And then it was a crucial 3rd down pass play where Rodgers dropped back. He had about 6 seconds to throw, and he found Randall Cobb for the go-ahead 1st down beyond the 2-minute warning. Brady starts dropping F-bombs, and the game is over. They just ran out the clock. And then you look at the Dallas game the week before, and it was a similar situation. Green Bay was driving, trying to put the game away, And on third down, they put the ball in Rodgers' hands again. He throws that pass that got deflected, but somehow was still caught, I believe, by Randall Cobb again. This game was different. And that's where I was confused, Anthony. You can help me with this because I don't understand what Mike McCarthy was thinking where, you know, he's got the, even on one leg, he's got the best quarterback in the business. And rather than being aggressive and trying to get those first downs to close out the game, on one possession, he ran it twice and then threw it on third down incomplete. They punted it. They got the ball back about a minute later. And then they ran it three times in a row before punting it again, just running only 60 seconds off the clock. I mean, that if I was a Packers fan, that might be the hardest part for me to swallow.
Well, let me add some little bit of information I came across. Apparently, the Seattle Seahawks doubted one particular player for that specific situation. And that is our mutual friend, Joey Hubris. That's his favorite player, Brad Jones. And apparently, Shane has a very poor set of skills when it comes to football, and he just completely sells out every time he's in that situation, no matter what. They're like, okay, well, when we want to call a fake, if he's on the field, we're going to call a fake, and it's going to the kicker or the punter, whoever it is going to roll out to his side, and the tight end on that side can either they're going to go out for a route, and depending on how far it is or what the linebacker does, who's not Brad Jones, who's behind him, in this case it was A.J. Hawk, the kicker has to make the linebacker make a decision. Come after me or I'm throwing to the guy. So it's a pretty, almost like a little bit of an option type play. And it's all built on the fact that they know that every single time this terrible player makes a terrible play, they can count on it. And they literally walked out there very confidently that they would be able to score this touchdown, or at least get the first down, because in fact Brad Jones refused to have any type of forethought when he's on kick coverage.
So what you're saying is Brad Jones, who was on the Packers special teams unit, was chiefly responsible for the mix-up or the blunder, if you will, on that fake field goal.
Chiefly is a strong term, but I wouldn't say that.
And so in regards to the last two series that Green Bay had the ball before Seattle took the lead, where if they get a first down, they basically end the game, and McCarthy runs it three times in a row. To me, that was where his conservative nature came back to bite him, especially when in similar circumstances earlier in the season, he didn't go that route. And, I mean, Rodgers is still Rodgers, and he showed that on the last drive when he was able to get that field goal to force overtime. He can still make plays. To take the ball out of your best player's hands seemed weird to me.
I agree. It's weird. The I don't know if he's very concerned about the leg or something. You know, the leg could have been a little worse off as the game went on, as opposed to getting stronger, apparently. Not apparently. It looked like he got stronger at the end of the Cowboys game, and maybe he was feeling worse at the end of this game. You never know how that kind of stuff works. He, like I said, they decided to play as conservatively as possible to try and use as much clock, and I don't think they used the clock right, and it was very strange. I'm not sure why Rodgers may not have checked from a run to a pass, and maybe they have issues with the leg or what they were seeing with the coverage, but it's a little baffling that, like you said, they take it out of their best player's hand. And the Seattle defense was not, the secondary was not necessarily playing great. Maybe it was a couple of turnovers, but that Rodgers threw, they were uncharacteristic, miscommunications, but it's weird. I don't understand what's going on. And it's unfortunate because, you know, as I think it was Dennis Green said, you know, you had them where you want them or whatever. And it's like, you can't just let a guy like Russell Wilson, who I think is probably the third best quarterback in the NFL right now, can't lose the opportunity of having him play his worst game ever. And then having having the entire Seattle Seahawks defense not play their dominating style across the board. So it's just they let all those things go a couple of times, and then they still were in it because Seattle's playing that poorly.
Is any of this on Rodgers? Because from like a legacy talk, I know it's ignorant of us as you know, podcasters or bloggers or commentators, reporters, whatever you want to call it, to jump into the legacy discussion at every turn. But how much, if any, of this is on Rodgers? Because this did happen on his watch. This deficit, even though he wasn't the primary reason why it happened, he didn't play great in this game. Even though he was on one leg, he was still out there, and he got the credit when he was on one leg, and they beat Dallas. How much of this is on him? Because this happened on his watch, and to your point, he didn't check off in any of these run plays. He didn't audible, and I feel like he probably has the latitude to pull a audible in that kind of situation, right?
Yeah. As far as his legacy, I mean, his legacy is going to be fine. You know, as quarterback play and the way we measure quarterback success, it's just getting more and more efficient. Almost like how there's a whole movement in basketball. Rodgers has got some of the most efficient numbers in the history of the game. But his numbers are fine. He has the out of that thing. He has a leg that's been bothering him for close to 6 weeks. If it was a situation where he was more cheaply involved in their falling behind, then maybe, but even then, that'd be stupid. He's 7 years or 7 or 8 years as a starter, and he's an MVP, a Super Bowl ring, the like highest quarterback rating in the history of the game, or something silly like that. His touchdown to interception ratio is ridiculous. And, I mean, he's basically what you would tell a computer to make as far as a quarterback. And he's sitting out there doing it, even he has one leg. I don't think there's a legacy issue for Aaron Rodgers. The fact of the matter is, he is still going to be able to. The fact was like this. If he was to play at his continued rate for another 5 or 6 years, which is probably a decent time before he starts to decline, unless he gets injured, he's going to have some excellent numbers, and they're going to be more efficient than anyone else. He won't have the raw yardage numbers just because he waited to start for so long. But, I mean, his legacy is fine. It's unfortunate what's happened, but, I mean, he's been put out by the top defenses for the past 4 years, except for the Giants, I believe, when they won the title that year. So you have to be really, really good to beat Aaron Rodgers, and the really, really good teams have found a way to beat him.
Interesting point. It just seemed weird that some people are kind of laying this on him. I think he probably deserves a little blame, but he's way down the list of people that probably deserve criticism for the reason why the Packers did not prevail in that game. And his performance in the playoffs in general was heroic, but it was kind of unfortunate because they looked like the better team. And I'm sure you feel that the Packers are better than the Seahawks. I've always liked Seattle. I said at the beginning of the year, I thought New Orleans was going to make the Super Bowl, but I thought that Seattle going into the season was the best team. And if you would have told me at the beginning of the year that Seattle would have had home field, I would have picked them all the way, which a lot of people kind of came to the same conclusion, as I did at the start of the playoffs. But and I like the Seahawks except for Doug Baldwin. I officially do not like Doug Baldwin. Because after the game, Doug Baldwin loses his mind on like multiple occasions, screaming at reporters and on camera and stuff, talking about no one believed in us and this is what we do and y'all counted us out, and going all the way back to the beginning of the year, y'all counted us out. We were 3-3 and 6-4 and nobody believed in us. And it's like, dog, everybody believed in you. What are you talking about? Like, everybody knew that you're the defending champs. Everybody. Like, what are we supposed to say? Like, we're supposed to get behind you when you're down 16-0 and playing like garbage for the first, you know, 54 minutes of the game? We're supposed to say, oh, yeah, Seattle's got this. Like, no, you guys are playing like trash. What are people supposed to think? And how would he know? And how would he even know unless he's on Twitter at halftime looking at tweets and stuff about how garbage his team is playing in the first half? I just didn't get that. That whole thing with him rubbed me the wrong way. I don't know if you feel that strongly about it, but it annoyed me.
I completely agree. I saw it, and it was just like, what do you mean no one believes in you? Everyone just assumes you guys are going to figure it out. That's stupid. No one wins in Seattle except for when they were, like, dealing with whatever issues were, and the Cowboys beat them, I believe. No one is really looking forward to playing them at any given time. They've got one of the best young quarterbacks. They've got one of the best defenses. They've got, you know, Marshawn Lynch literally stealing people's souls on the field every week. I mean, it's just a matter of just trying to play that role because you came from behind and won. You're the Super Bowl champion. You should be able to do that at home with a team that is clearly lacking the confidence to really, you know, put their foot on your throat. They really basically did you a favor, and you should be happy about it. You can lose your mind about it, but to play the nobody believes in us card when you're the number one overall seed is patently ridiculous.
Knock it off, Doug Baldwin. I think that's kind of what we're getting at. Real quick, Anthony, at the start of the season, I think you had Denver and Green Bay meeting in Super Bowl 49. Not too far off, but given that we know the combatants this time around, real quick, give me your prediction for the game.
I mean, I think it's going to be the Seahawks winning somewhat comfortably. I just don't see I don't see them losing and playing such terrible football 2 weeks in a row. And if there's anybody who can try and slow down Gronkowski, it's the Seahawks, and specifically, and I am blanking on his name. He's the guy who decided he just doesn't care. He's going to jump over Panthers players to block kicks.
I said that was insane.
Yeah, and he did it twice. The first time was insane. The second one, it was just like, oh, in case you missed it. Don't worry about DVR. I got you. I did it again. I mean, I just think they have this skill set to confuse and frustrate and get Tom Brady moving. And I think that the Patriots are going to come out and be exceptionally motivated due to all this ball deflate nonsense. But, you know, I don't see it. You know, Russell Wilson, I will say it to my dying day, he played that entire game with concussion because Clay Matthews busted in the face and his knee went the opposite direction. He played the entire game with concussion and he still was money waiting at it. So, you know, they're going to probably come out there and somehow get a win. Not somehow. I think they're the better team. I think Seahawks are the best team in the league, and they're going to win another Super Bowl.
There you have it. Anthony Houston joining us on the Hip Hop Sports Report Super Bowl edition of the podcast. Kicking that brand new flavor in your ear. Anthony, thanks for joining us. The concussion thing, that's a whole other issue that really hasn't gotten a lot of play, is Russell Wilson potentially playing with a concussion during that game after he got rocked, I think, by Clay Matthews, basically right in his jaw. But like I said, that's a whole separate issue. We got some other guests coming on in this episode, so we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks for joining us tonight, Anthony.
No problem. Have a good one.
Yep. Peace. All right, all right. And now for a little AFC perspective, let's check in on our man Adam Clark. Let's hit him up right now.
My man, what's up?
Hello, Adam. How you doing, man?
Super good. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, and we are already recording. I already got you on the podcast, wasting no time, man.
Oh, fire away.
How you been?
Oh, real good, real good.
Except
what about
football
you?
Sense. I was going to say, except in a football sense, you haven't maybe been as good of late.
I think that's a fair assessment, man. That is a... As a Colts fan, this is the time of year where you just think, man, if you're not going to win a Super Bowl, why even get in the playoffs and ruin your draft pick? You know what I'm saying?
Well, let me ask you this. You're the biggest Colts fan I know just about. And
all right.
And you have historically hated the Patriots and Tom Brady, and not from a standpoint of you hate on them because, you know, you don't have any real reason behind it, but you just think they're good and you just hate the fact that they're good. No, you literally hate them because they are your arch rivals and you can't stand them. And when we spoke last by text during the AFC Championship game, you were telling me how embarrassed you were by the performance of your team. Would you care to expand on that a little bit?
Well, yeah, here's the thing, man. When you get to that stage in the game, conference championship, one game away from the Super Bowl, you bring your best. You bring everything in the kitchen sink, as they say. That you bring it all. And what I saw from the Colts in the week where they played the Broncos in Denver was this extremely well thought out and well executed game plan, both on offense and defense. Just really like thinking ahead, knowing what Denver was planning on doing, anticipating their stuff on defense, having an answer for every one of their problems that they raised. It was really well done. And I was like, man, Pep Hamilton, like really putting some offensive drives together that were pretty impressive against a Denver defense that, you know, throughout the season had good moments. Not that they're as good as the Seahawks are this time of year, but I guess I'm just saying I didn't think we were going to win that game as handily as we did. Anyway, so I thought, man, you know, I'm optimistic going into New England, at least at some level, that we're going to make it a game. And to see the exact opposite, when it's like these are supposed to be the four best teams, and it looked like three extremely good teams that totally belong there and the Indianapolis Colts. And so I was just really embarrassed to be the team that was lucky to get there. You know, at that stage in the game, you should no longer be happy to be there. You should be like, okay, we're one game away from the Super Bowl. We're gonna get there, and we're going to get there, you know, bringing our best stuff. And it just didn't seem like we had that approach from moment one. We seemed, if you will, deflated.
Funny you should bring that up. That's a marvelous transition. I can tell you've worked in radio before. let me start here. Let me alert our listeners now, because we actually started recording on Sunday with Anthony Houston joining the show, and now we have the Adam Clark on the show. We've actually fast forwarded to Tuesday, y'all. So now it's Tuesday, just to put that out there. But now Media Day was today. The Super Bowl is happening in 5 days, I believe. Now we're gonna talk a lot about Deflategate, but I wanted to step back actually, and I'm gonna go a different direction first. And maybe this is just, I don't want to go as far as to say that calling myself a Colts hater, because I don't, even though I've been kind of anti-Manning for a long time, I'm not really a Colts hater per se, but I feel like there's an untold story here that hasn't gotten nearly enough attention, and I want to get your take on it as it relates to Deflategate. Now, the Colts, as the story goes, as we understood the story, DeQuell Jackson intercepted Tom Brady in the first half. He throws the ball to the officials. He throws the ball to a team equipment manager on the Colts. That individual notices something fishy was going on with the ball. They inspect it. They said, you know what, let's swap out these balls for the second half. They use better, properly regulated balls for the second half. Comes out after the game that 11 of the 12 balls used by New England were deflated below regulation. And come to find out since then, allegedly, that information either came from the Colts from their previous game where they played each other in the middle of the season, where Indianapolis was a little skeptical of New England's practices with the football. Either that, or they received a tip from the Baltimore Ravens, who we already know had some beef with some of the Patriots' tactics in their AFC divisional round game. They tipped off the Colts, and then a sting operation was set up to try to nail the Patriots in the AFC championship game. This is what's happening right now in football. So, having said all that, let me touch on, an undersold story, I feel like, right now. Because what we saw from the Indianapolis Colts years ago was in the 2004 AFC championship game. The Patriots were very physical with the receivers, and the Colts could not hold up to it, basically. And Manning's timing was disrupted, and the Colts lost the game pretty handily. Now, after the game, the Colts complained. They complained to the officials. They complained to the league that their receivers are getting harassed. The league said, no, it's legal. It's fine. Under the current construct of the rules, this is legal. Then they complain some more at the Pro Bowl, and then Tony Dungy gets on it. He's complaining. Then they send a tape into the league after the Pro Bowl, complaining some more. Next thing you know, Bill Polian, who was the president of the Colts, was sitting on the board of the competition committee. All of a sudden, a new rule gets pushed through, and now we have illegal contact, basically saying that you cannot touch receivers 5 yards beyond the line of scrimmage. And then after that, the Colts won the Super Bowl. So we have that history everybody wants to talk about the history of Spygate. I think, Adam, you see where I'm going with this. So we have that history as a foundation. Now we have this incident after the Colts got destroyed by the Patriots again. And I can't help but wonder, are the Indianapolis Colts a bunch of punks? And Adam, I want you to understand the brevity of this as far as in my head anyway. Like, I really feel like using a word stronger than punks that actually starts with the letter P and has five letters. I think you get where I'm going with that.
Oh, my word. I get where you're going with that.
Okay. So am I wrong? Is any part of this related to that, or is this two totally separate issues? And again, I don't want to make it sound like I'm excusing the Patriots, because if they're guilty, then by all means, they need to be punished. But is there any bit of truth to that the Colts are basically just sore losers?
Well, okay. Yes. I will answer your question as specifically as I can. Yes, I think there is an element to which the Colts are sore losers. But I think more than that, I think that the Colts, because they have had sort of this consistent success over the last 15, 17 years, but we've struggled to get it all the way done. You know what I'm saying? We've only won that one Super Bowl, but we've been a 10-win team. We've been a divisional champion, you know, so many of the last 17 years that we've got this sort of little brother syndrome, right, where it's like we're fast, we're strong, but we're never as fast and strong as that cool older brother. And it's totally in our head and under our skin. And so I think there's an extent to which I can say as a fan, yes, that's true. And so I don't know about the organizational thing. Like, what you outlined there is a conspiracy theory that I think goes beyond what we've encountered here. I don't think that it's that systemic, as far as, like, you know, it's really a complete change in lineup. The coaches aren't the same. The quarterback's not the same. The personnel between that 2004 game and what happened 2 weeks ago, totally different. So I don't think that's apples and oranges to me. But what I do believe is the happiest people on earth the last 8 days are the folks at ESPN. They have never had more show fodder than for the week before the Super Bowl than this year. They love Deflategate. This is Christmas. And the worst thing that can happen is for Colts fans to have a reason to complain. As a Colts fan, I love my people. I am my people. But this is like exactly the kind of thing we don't need as a group. We don't need another reason to be the entitled, whiny younger brother. The fact is that game was 38 points apart, and there's no, you know, two PSI that closes that gap that much. And so we just got to say Tom Brady right now is Andrew Luck's cool older brother, and he's just better. And that, I'm, to be honest with you, I'm realistic enough to say that's fine with me, because Andrew Luck has a lot of great years ahead of him. He's done better every time he's come into the playoffs. This is the best he's done yet. I think the brighter years are ahead of him. I feel pretty good. Outside of an embarrassing showing in the AFC Championship game, I feel good about the future. And so I'm willing to just say, hey, we lost. There you go. Deflategate, separate situation as far as, like, if the Patriots are cheating, they're cheating. You know what I'm saying? Like, 2 PSI is – it's a big enough disparity that, you know, it necessitates investigation. How that gets set up, I don't think that's that big of a conspiracy theory, man. That may just be me giving the Colts a pass as a Colts fan. But I just think it's a terrible thing for Colts fans to have just one more reason to be like, see, we are the best. We are the best. And if it wouldn't have been for, you know, fill in the blank, that would be us. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. You raise a great point, too, about the maturation of this Colts team, and with Luck in particular, and Pagano for that matter, that Andrew Luck as a rookie made the playoffs, which is a great accomplishment for any rookie quarterback, especially coming into a team that I think was 2-14 the year before, 1-15, something like that. And then they advanced one division, or excuse me, they advanced one round later into the playoffs the following year, and then a round later this year. So each year he's progressed on this pace, he's going to be in the Super Bowl next year. So I mean, you can't get but so mad if you're a Colts fan. But again, to your point, LeGarrette Blount ran for 148 yards and 3 scores, every time that the Patriots and Colts hook up since Andrew Luck has gotten there, the Patriots have ran wild. They ran like they're mad at the grass every single game. And so you can't, you know, and again, I think you also made a good point, because I know a lot of Colts fans, and I haven't heard many of them point the finger and say, see, we would have won if not for this deflated football situation. I haven't heard anybody say that, thankfully, because that would be the most idiotic, asinine take that you could have from this football game. The deflated football situation had no impact on the AFC Championship game's outcome. Now, whether or not they were doing this beforehand, I think it's fair to assume that they were, if they were knowingly doing it. And, you know, maybe it does have an impact on a closer game, like, say, the Baltimore game, for instance. My thing with Deflategate, though, is right now, and I understand why the Patriots are not getting the benefit of the doubt, and they're not getting the benefit of the doubt because of Spygate, and I get that. And then just for a host of other little, I don't know if scurvy is the right word, but little scurvy things that they do, just, you know, with the injury reports and just the, you know, the Belichick just being prickly with the media all the time. And there's a lot of comeuppance here, I feel like, for the Patriots, and everybody is piling on them at this point. Now, my biggest gripe with that is that if we look at this individual case, you know, I mean, the Patriots, they did their time. They were punished for Spygate. That's over and done with. Now here we are again, and supposedly every team in the league kind of tampers with the balls in some way. But this is the one that's come up. Now, the problem is that there's no hard evidence to convict. There is no hard evidence that says Bill Belichick or Tom Brady laid down an edict that said, we need these footballs deflated before every game or before this Sunday's game against the Colts or else.
Right.
And there's no evidence, even though they've supposedly zeroed in on some locker room attendant or something like that. There's, to this point, as we're recording this podcast, there's no evidence that directly links Tom Brady or Bill Belichick to this scandal. And so,
right,
but they're not being treated that way. Neither one of them, not even Brady, who Spygate was kind of Teflon on the Spygate situation. He kind of slipped past that. Most of that fell on Belichick. Neither one of them have been able to get by in this situation. And so I think that's a little bit wrong. Call me, you know, a Brady homer or whatever, but there's no evidence to suggest that they've done anything wrong. So beyond the fact that I think that this is a very minor indiscretion, I don't see how anybody can hold this against the Patriots when they haven't really done anything wrong
that we know of.
Well, you know what? Yeah, right. And to be honest with you, I just think because of what ESPN is and because of what a lot of, you know, sports entities that try and follow suit are, this is getting blown up in a major way, particularly because of the timing. This is a week, historically, the week before Radio Row, the week before Media Day, where they've got nothing to talk about. We're talking about the road to the Final Four. We're talking about midseason NBA. There's nothing football related to really do, because you've got this whole week to get people hyped for the game. So, like, this has been a feast, a frenzy of coverage that has been Deflategate. And I just think that's really what's happening here. It's more, it's just media hype than anything else. I think if this happens at a different point in the season, with a different team involved, it's not getting covered this way. However, I have to say, and this is separate from the issue maybe, but the one thing that I hate but respect about the Patriots is they're phenomenal at handling controversy. They're phenomenal at it. Like, they're better with PR than almost any other team I've ever witnessed. And it's indicative of their management. Like, I think that they are really willing to cut talented players who are locker room problems. They're quick to say, okay, if there's even a doubt that Aaron Hernandez is involved in this stuff, he's gone, and we're refunding anybody's money or letting them trade out jerseys for Aaron Hernandez jerseys. They distance themselves from problems so quickly, so decisively. They've owned mistakes. Bill Belichick owned Spygate. Like, he wasn't dodging that. And they have been terrible about Deflategate. They just have, man. Like, the posture that they've taken in these press conferences has been so not convincing. And the fact that Bill Belichick called this, like, panicked feeling Saturday 19-minute impromptu symposium on football science, on deflation, with using a bunch of like high school science physics words was so weird. That was so uncharacteristic of Bill Belichick. That made it feel like, man, what is going on here? Why are you doing that? Because normally, if he didn't do it, he just stands there and says in his little grumbly tone, well, I didn't do it. At the end of the day, we made a couple more plays than they did, and that's just what happened. You know what I mean? But this time, he feels like he's got to give like this impassioned speech about football inflation and deflation. And Tom Brady plays this hilarious, dumb, I'm just a quarterback, I don't really do that stuff kind of card. And it's just like, no, if you didn't do it, you didn't do it. Own it. You're the best there is. So you can't tell me you didn't tell the difference. You know what I mean? Like, you're the top of the top of this position. So you knew that there was a difference in how it felt. And you can't play it any other way, right? So to me, that's been a really fascinating part of all of this. And then Robert Kraft calling an impromptu press conference as well to say, if this comes out and we didn't do anything wrong, I think that the NFL owes my guys an apology and my organization an apology. I just think this is the worst job that the Patriots have done in the face of controversy when it comes to the PR side than any other time I've seen them. That's my take on like what's different about this than any other thing that I've seen.
I agree with about 90% of what you just said. And 90's an A where I come from. I think Brady, it was funny. They nailed him pretty good on Saturday Night Live. Did you see that?
Oh, it was so good. Oh, it's $26.5 million a lot? I don't know things. It's phenomenal.
Right. The whole aw shucks, like, palms open, like, palms up. Like, I didn't know. What was I supposed to do?
That was vintage hat, crew neck sweatshirt, playing dumb. It's awesome.
That was solid. And so I think you're right that Brady was a little inconsistent with his message. That on one hand, he couldn't tell the difference. And then on the other hand, he says, well, 12.5 PSI is perfect for me. And it's like, well, you're getting pretty technical for somebody who can't tell the difference. So I agree that there was some weird things that came out in his press conference. And the two Belichick press conferences were interesting, too, especially they were calling him Mr. Wizard on Twitter on Saturday, which is
fantastic.
Yeah, the part that I disagree with you about was Robert Kraft. I actually like Robert Kraft's response on Monday because he had to say something, and I guess he doesn't take part in media day, so he knew he had to come out and say something as soon as he got there because people were going to be asking questions. Well, how come Robert Kraft hasn't said anything yet? It had to happen at some point. And frankly, I kind of agree with him that, again, given the fact that there's no hard evidence linking the Patriots to any wrongdoing, and that Bill Belichick, for whatever it's worth, gave his explanation on Saturday as to what the Patriots believe was the reason why those footballs were deflated, that you can't get mad at Robert Kraft for saying, well, look, if the NFL can run their investigation, we all know the NFL's track record with investigations. If they come back and say that they did not find anything wrong, then everybody owes us an apology. The league, the media, the fans, everybody that dragged our names through the mud. I'm standing up for my coach. I'm standing up for my quarterback. And I'm standing up for my team. I have no problem with Robert Kraft doing that. So, I mean, I think I
get what you're saying. And to an extent, I agree with you. But I think that this is where, still, this is a different approach historically than we've seen from New England. And that's where I think it's kind of weird. Because in a situation where they don't have anything to defend, I feel like it's more like New England to wait for the NFL to come to them, finish their investigation, it's all said and done with, and then for Robert Kraft to calmly, without like being, you know, wrapped up in the emotion of it, to say, listen, my guys are clear, I stand behind them, and I think the NFL owes us an apology. But to get out there like proactively out in front of it and like call an impromptu thing, I guess what I'm saying is it just feels different than like the normal New England, like, they never panic, man. This is an organization that never panics. And I hate that. I wish they were Jerry Jones. As a Colts fan, I wish that they just reacted and like did stupid things, but they never do. And I just feel like the front office and coach and quarterback on this one seemed very not New England. And I don't know. So I can see what you're saying. And I don't think what he said was wrong. I just think it's uncharacteristic of New England.
Fair enough. Now, if you recall, we had you on the podcast You graced us with your presence on the preseason podcast of the year back in August, and we made our Super Bowl predictions. Mine was New England over New Orleans. I don't recall off the top of my head what your prediction was. Do you remember what it was?
I'm pretty sure. I don't know. I would need to go back and listen because I'm going to feel stupid if I don't even remember my picks. But I'm pretty sure I thought it was a Super Bowl rematch.
I think you did too. I'm pretty sure you had Denver in it, and I think you did have a rematch in it. So quickly, because we're short on time, give us your picks for the game and a quick reason as to why.
Well, I think Seattle's got a lot of like really positive momentum going into this game. I think that they look right on media day. You know, like they look like really in their element. And I think as much as I would normally say something like this would be fuel for New England's fire, they would come out ready to go, they would come out on top, I really think that Seattle looks more comfortable right now. And I know that's nothing to do with the numbers or what may actually happen on the field, but maybe that's good. Maybe I should just pick on something that's not, you know, the historical, facts that may be in play. I just have this feeling that Seattle's walking in here looking like the team, looking, I guess, like the cool older brother. You know what I'm saying? Like, New England doesn't look as cool right now as they normally do. They look a little bit hot-headed. They look a little bit ill at ease. This Deflategate thing has chased them much longer than I think they thought it would. And so I give the upper hand, at least psychologically right now, to Seattle. And, man, a team like that, all they need is the psychology because they've got the talent. If they're in your head, it's over with, man. I really think they're strong. So I'd love to see him repeat because I hate the Patriots, but I think they really will.
At least you're honest, but you have good information and reasons as to back that up, and that's all we could ask for.
Well, and hey, I will say before I'm done, you being your friend has brought me to a much more reasonable place about Tom Brady's excellence as a quarterback and his place in history. So I'll give credit where credit's due if I'm wrong about this. He's amazing. And if he wins this time, I just think there's nothing standing between us as Colts fan and anybody else saying this dude's something else. He's the all-time great.
We're going to talk a little bit about that with our next guest. But thank you, Adam, for joining us this evening on the preseason podcast of the year. Adam Clark, my hat and my heart goes out to you just because you're awesome. And I felt for you getting killed in the championship game, man. My heart was hurting for you, man. But you took it like a G today. You took it like a G today on the podcast. Thank you for joining us.
No, thank you. You're my man in the whole 50 grand. Thanks for having me.
No problem, man. One. All right. And now on to our third and final guest of the evening to talk about the actual game itself on Sunday, our good friend Vince Hicks. Hello, Vince.
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you for joining the Hip Hop Sports Report podcast again. How you feeling this evening?
I'm doing well.
All right, man. Now, we've had a couple of guests on already. Shout out to Anthony Houston. Shout out to Adam Clark, our good friends of the podcast. And now you are the third guest, the final piece of the puzzle, my man. We're going to talk the game. We're going to look at the Super Bowl itself. We're going to break it all down right quick. We only got about 15 minutes or so we gotta be efficient with our time. Can we handle that?
Sound good. All I'm right. ready.
All right, bet. Now, and coming off the conversation I just had with Adam, we talked a lot about Deflategate, which, you know, I'm assuming that you're thinking like I'm thinking, that it's really much ado about nothing, but it's still turned into a big story for whatever reason. And I'm kind of feeling like, you know, I told Adam off air, I kind of feel like the only out for the Patriots right now, because their reputation's been dragged through the mud, the names have been just dragged, and Brady's name is mud, Belichick's is mud, the whole organization from top to bottom, everybody thinks they're trash now. I mean, exactly. I think it's ludicrous, but at this point, I feel like the only way out for them is to destroy the Seahawks, because if they lose, then everybody's going to be all over them. And if they win a close game, people are still going to be all over them, and they're going to say, oh, well, maybe y'all shouldn't have, maybe if y'all didn't do this, and the third, people are going to assume that they cheated somehow, and that's what was the difference in the close game. I feel like the only way that they can really save face is if they blow out the Seahawks. How do you feel about that?
I think that's a clear-cut way to keep the naysayers and the doubters quiet, but it would be hard to do. I mean, let me go on record first saying I do pick the Patriots to win the Super Bowl, but I think it's going to be a close game. Just about the way Seattle plays, it makes games close. I mean, they have the defense to keep your offense not in a great rhythm, and then they kind of control the ball with their running game, and they also have a running quarterback who picks up, you know what I'm saying, third downs when, you know, you need to extend the clock. So with his legs, even without having to pass the ball. So I think it's going to be a close game, but I think your statement is correct, that the only way they can shut everybody up is to by blowing them out. But I don't even know how it got that far out of control. I think it's more of a jealousy thing against the Patriots organization. That's just in my opinion.
And I discussed that with Adam as well. Just the fact that all these ex-ball players, everybody's coming out the woodwork now, and they're standing in the batter's box, and they're taking their swings. They're taking their cuts at the Patriots because the Patriots have been on top for 15 years, and they have been the gold standard, right?
Exactly. And I think that's exactly what it is. And the organization, like, you know, they got a guy in LeGarrette Blount, who got cut by the Steelers midway through the season. Now he's playing in the Super Bowl. I mean, they turn misfits that other people don't want and have issues with. They turn misfits into Super Bowl caliber players. And I think organizations and players that haven't played with the Patriots are mad at it. You know what I'm saying? And for them to drag Tom Brady, like, whether it's some truth or validity to the situation or not, for them to throw and drag Tom Brady through the mud with his track record as being a consummate professional on and off the football field is a little bit of an embarrassment to me for the NFL in general, period.
You mentioned Tom Brady, and, you know, again, I have to reiterate, everybody that knows, okay, y'all know that I'm a Tom Brady apologist. I think he's the best quarterback I've ever seen. I think he is on any objective person's list as far as the greatest quarterbacks of the Super Bowl era. I don't see how he could be any lower than third. And I mean, I'm a younger dude, so I haven't seen everybody, but from what I've seen and from what I know, and granted the league has been shaped now to where quarterbacks reign supreme, and that every it's a passing league, obviously, and that's so cliche, but it's true. What would this Super Bowl do for Brady's legacy? Because if he wins this game amidst all this controversy going in, he would have 4 out of 6 appearances. Nobody else has more appearances. Nobody else has more playoff wins. Nobody has a higher regular season win percentage. He's got 2 MVP awards. He would have at least two Super Bowl MVP awards. I mean, is he untouchable at that point if he wins this game? Is that where we're at? Or is there any way that somebody can still question how great he is? Because I don't feel like they can, really.
Well, you know, it's obviously with people already saying at this point in his career that Peyton Manning is a better quarterback, they'll find a way to say somebody is better. Hey, he doesn't get the credit that he deserves. And I'm on that list, too. I think, I mean, I've seen great quarterbacks, and I like great quarterbacks. But to me, out of the great quarterbacks I've seen, I will put him at number one. And it has a lot to do with a lot of different things. But it'll be an issue with somebody. Somebody will say something about something because that's just the way they do with Brady. Like the way the Super Bowls that the Giants won, it was Eli Manning was a better quarterback than Tom Brady in the playoff games, even though Tom Brady put his team in a situation to win both Super Bowls with under 4 minutes left in both games. Who does that in, you know, and the defense can't hold, and you have spectacular plays and amazing things happen. And then people say, oh, Tom Brady's not really that good. I mean, it's like I said, it all goes back to me with some kind of jealousy or something that has to do with this guy in the organization. Maybe it's the organization, and it's a trickle-down effect. They don't like the Patriots, so they don't like Belichick, so they don't like Brady. And it's a trickle. I mean, like Ray Lewis is a Hall of Famer, was one of the greatest linebackers I've seen play, and for him to say Tom Brady's career was made on the fumble in Oakland, the tuck rule play is ridiculous. You know what I'm saying? Like that sounds like a total jealousy to me. You know what I'm saying? It's ridiculous to have this man's legacy questioned the way it has been questioned already. And if he wins this Super Bowl, they'll find another way to question it. That's just the way it is.
And that's unfortunate if that's the case, too. And you mentioned earlier the defenses. I wanted to take a quick second to touch upon that. Now, you contacted me. I want to make this known. You contacted me and said, Jay, I need to get on a podcast because I got to talk about Richard Sherman. Now,
absolutely.
Now, before we get into that real quick, I want to shout out Richard Sherman and Marshawn Lynch and Russell Wilson. We just tonight posted an article about the Seattle Seahawks, those three players in particular, and their brands of leadership and how they impacted their teams and how they're changing the perceptions of black athletes. So I want to shout those guys out. I like Richard Sherman. I got love for Richard Sherman. I got love for Darrell Revis, too. A lot of people think they're 1-2, and they've even gone at it on Twitter themselves. But I need you to take a couple seconds and tell me what it is that irks you about Richard Sherman.
Well, this is my biggest problem with Richard Sherman. I believe Richard Sherman is a very solid cornerback. And, I mean, his biggest upside to me is his ball skills. He used to play wide receiver at Stanford before they made him a defensive back. So he knows how to get the ball when it comes his way. I'll give him that credit. But as far as him being an elite cornerback, he's not on my list of elite cornerback. He's not over Joe Hayden. He's not over Darrell Revis. He's not over Patrick Peterson. He's not over Aqib Talib. Anybody you could say, because Richard Sherman stays on one side of the field. So he does not play the best wide receiver every game. So all the stats go out the window. Oh, yeah, Joe Hayden has given up a 50-yard pass to A.J. Green, or Darrell Revis has given up this big a pass to a Calvin Johnson. But, yeah, Darrell Revis played Calvin Johnson for 70 plays in the game, or A.J. Green was played by Joe Hayden for 70 plays in the game because they shadowed the best receiver. So, obviously, you're going to give up big plays because great receivers make great plays. When Richard Sherman plays the Packers in week one of the season, he plays rookie Devontae Adams in his first game. He doesn't check Jordy Nelson one play. He doesn't check Randall Cobb one play. So how can you can say that you're the greatest if you haven't beaten the greatest? You know, that's like a fighter saying, oh, yeah, I'm the greatest because I'm 50-0, and he got a bunch of tomato cans on his record. You know what I'm saying? This guy, and he talks like he plays Jerry Rice every down in a football game. But if he was playing in that era, he wouldn't guard Jerry Rice, and he probably wouldn't even guard John Taylor. So for him to make all the noise that he makes is ridiculous, and for people to give him the credibility, it makes no sense because he's not doing that. And you could say it's their scheme and it's whatever, but as the best, you want to play the best. And Joe Hayden is, to me, a far better cornerback than Richard Sherman because, number one, he doesn't have his size, you know what I'm saying? And he's a smaller guy, but look at the AFC North Division. Look at the players you got there at wide receiver. You got A.J. Green. You got Torrey Smith or Steve Smith, whoever you want to say, with Baltimore. And then we know who we got in Pittsburgh. He's probably going to win, you know what I'm saying, Offensive Player of the Year, you know what I'm saying, besides any quarterback. You know what I'm saying? So this is the guy he plays six games out the year every single snap. So, if he got beat by a 50-yard pass or a 40-yard pass, it's going to happen. You know what I'm saying? Because he plays those guys every game. But you know what I'm saying? Who does Richard Sherman play every game? Whoever comes to that side? And for him to talk like he's the greatest, it makes no sense to me. And it's incomprehensible for anybody who says they know football, especially the cornerback position, to compare him to those guys. You know what I'm saying? To compare him to, that's like saying Kirk Cousins is the best quarterback because he came off the bench and played. They had no scouting report on him. You know what I'm saying? It's things that go into the game that people don't realize. And as soon as they figure guys out, you know what I'm saying, that's something different. But like I said, you'll never figure them out because as a coach, if they say Richard Sherman is the best defensive back on the Seahawks, guess who I'm going to put my best receiver on? The other guy.
Yeah,
it's a matchup. That's the matchup you want. You want your best guy against their worst guy. You don't
it's like in basketball when at the beginning of the game, the star player doesn't guard the other star player because they don't want to get them in foul trouble, so they're going to go to a different matchup.
Exactly. You just go to your best matchup. You go, I mean, why would I, you know what I'm saying? I don't know what Richard Sherman is, but if they say Richard Sherman is the best quarterback on the cornerback on the Seahawks, and I know he stays one place, I'm going to put my best receiver on the guy that's worse than he is. So all these stats about he gets thrown to at less than other guys or he gives up less big plays, those stats are slanted, and you know what I'm saying? It's not a real statistical thing that you can measure. You can measure Patrick Peterson and Darrell Revis and Joe Hayden and Aqib Talib or whoever those lockdown corners, who's guys that move around to the best player all game. You can go at those guys' stats, measure them one-on-one, but you can't measure Richard Sherman's stats with the rest of those guys. So to me, it's a fraud to even put him, to compare him with in that aspect. It's like a guy coming off the bench playing the second team and you say he's the best. You know what I'm saying? Like, you played the scout team. Yeah, sure, you should, you know what I'm saying, have these many yards or do this great. But it just, it's a mockery of, you know what I'm saying, pro sports. And if I was Patrick Peterson, I mean, these guys argue on Twitter and Instagram and all that, but that'll be the first thing I'll bring up. You can't compare them to me because we're not the same guy. We're not in the same league. Yeah, you score 30 in the D League, but can you do it night in and night out in the NBA? You know what I'm saying? And that's how I look at Richard Sherman. He has D League statistics, so he can score 50 in the D League, but he's not playing the best of the best every down. So he's not comparable to any of those guys I mentioned. And if anybody want to argue that point with me, tell them to bring it on because they have no valid point. None.
Strong words, man. But you raise an interesting point, though, because, I mean, for instance, I've watched a ton of Browns games. Week two of the season, the Cleveland Browns played the New Orleans Saints, and guess who Joe Hayden was on? He wasn't on the receivers. He was on Jimmy Graham in the slot. So,
a former basketball player that weighs 250 pounds, and this guy is top 10, 185 pounds, 190 pounds.
And he held his own against Jimmy Graham, too. But
he holds his own all the time. Like, he holds his own. Like, look at A.J. Green's statistics against the Browns and everybody else. You know what I'm saying? It's just, look at, you know, it's just, like I said, to me it's not even comparable, and it's laughable for people to compare him to other guys.
I feel you on that, man. We are super duper short on time, though. Real quick, though, we got about 2.5-3 minutes left. What are your keys to victory? You already said you got the Patriots winning the game. What is your keys to victory? Because the way I see it, I see New England's going to have to contain Russell Wilson in the pocket. They're not going to have – he can't – they can't let him beat him on the option, and they can't let them – they can't let Wilson beat him with, you know, handing off to Lynch or keeping it himself and going around edge. New England has to keep containment. I don't see the Patriots blitzing at all in this game. I feel like they're going to try to get pressure on him with four, and they're going to hold everybody else back and try to contain Wilson in the pocket and make him beat him with his arm, whereas on the other side – I'm scared for the Patriots that Seattle's going to employ the same defensive game plan they did against Denver, which was they kept everybody in front of them. They said, okay, we don't believe you can beat us over the top. We're going to keep everything in front of you, and we're going to slap the hell out of your receivers. We're going to smash your receivers when they come over the middle. That's kind of how I perceive what the Seahawks game plan is going to be, because New England doesn't really have a deep downfield threat, and Brady's been inaccurate throwing the deep ball. So I kind of feel like they're going to employ the same strategy they did against the Broncos, and they're just going to limit them to short passes, and Edelman and Amendola and these little guys better keep a head on the swivel, man, because they might get laid out. What are your keys to the game tonight or Sunday night?
I would agree with that totally. For the pass on the defensive end, like you said, they have to gap integrity, have to contain Russell Wilson, make him beat you with the arm. Don't let Marshawn get in the beast mode. Make these Doug Baldwin and these guys beat you. If they beat you, that's what happens, you know, because you don't want to pick your poison with Lynch and Russell Wilson. And also, on the offensive end, I agree with what you say. I think they are going to get some deep balls down the middle of the seams of the field against the linebackers against Gronk, like down the middle of the field. And I think as far as in the red zone, it's going to be important. You know, they're going to have the threat of the run. I don't think they're going to run a lot, but they're going to have the threat of the run. little short passes, but in the red zone, I'm looking for deep fades and things that in the corner of the end zone when everybody is bunched up in the middle. The Patriots throw a lot of different formations at you, which gets their receivers open. I think that's going to be the key. But I'm looking at a close game, maybe 27-23 or something like that. A real close game, not real high score, but I think it's going to be a grind-out football game.
I would agree with you. As I think back to the Patriots Super Bowls that they've been in you know, since the Brady-Belichick regime took over, I kind of feel like the majority, except for the Carolina game, I don't think they've ever really scored many points in any of them. I think they scored about 24 against Philly, and they scored like 31 or something like that, or 32 against Carolina. Everything else has been in the teens, I think, all those other games. So I don't, you know, especially against this defense, it's probably going to be maybe even less scoring than what you even thought. At least that's what I would think going in. I mean, I could very well see a 20-17 type game or something like that. I think you have to figure that the more points that are scored, that favors the Patriots, because I don't think Seattle's offense can keep up. I'm sticking with my preseason pick of the New England Patriots to win the Super Bowl. I had them on the podcast before the year started, and I feel like they're the most complete team top to bottom. Even with all this controversy surrounding them, I think they're obviously well coached. They have obviously a great quarterback, but beyond that, their offense is still one of the top five offenses in the league. Their defense is one of the leaders in takeaways, as is Seattle's, but Seattle doesn't get as much pressure on the quarterback like they used to, and that's going to be a problem for them if Brady has time. This Seattle defense, last year's defense was better. I've heard people say that this year's team was better, or this year's defense rather is better than last year's defense. That is not true. This Seattle defense forces more turnovers. It gets more pressure on the quarterback, gets more sacks. This Seattle defense is less stingy against the run. We saw Jonathan Stewart get yards on Seattle. We saw Eddie Lacy picking up yards on Seattle. I believe LeGarrette Blount's going to get yards on Seattle. And then again, they haven't really played an elite quarterback aside from a one-legged Aaron Rodgers. They haven't played an elite quarterback since like week six. So a lot of Seattle's defensive statistics might be a little inflated. So and then the New England Patriots have the best special teams in the NFL, hands down, as well. So that's why I got to get a nod, y'all.
I got a Patriots in a close one, less than a touchdown, but we'll see.
I absolutely agree with you, man. I cannot wait for it. Thank you for joining us. Vince Hicks back on the podcast. Please check out the website, y'all, hiphopsportsreport.com. Twitter.com/HHS Report, Facebook.com/HHS Report. Thank you, Vince.
Appreciate Absolutely. You having me.
Yep, no doubt. Thank you, Vince. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Anthony. We out of here, y'all. Peace.